Racial tension in America has become a recurring topic of conversation in politics, the media, and everyday life. There are numerous explanations as to why this has become a predominant subject in today's news and who is to blame. Our next guest says as Americans prepare to once again cast their presidential ballots, it's more important than ever to have a smart and thoughtful conversation about race. Sociology professor Margaret Anderson's new book is Getting Smart About Race, which discusses why racial healing should be an integral element of our everyday discussions surrounding race and how to move the conversation in a positive direction. Again, the name of the book is Getting Smart About Race, an American Conversation, and we welcome Margaret Anderson to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Always nice to speak with you. Give us a sense of what brought you, obviously you've long had ties to the subject, but what brought you to put it in such terms that are pretty direct?
Well, that's a great way to open this up, because I will say I, for many years, have been teaching and writing about race, largely to college students and my academic colleagues. And when my latest book, written for such an audience, had come out about 3 years ago, at a time when our racial tensions were boiling over, a lot of my friends said to me, "This is so important now. You really should, you know, be getting this out there." Well, I knew that people were not going to sit and read a 350-page textbook full of footnotes and citations and graphs and figures. And so I decided to take what I know and what I've been teaching about for many years and write a book for the general public that was brief, conversational, full of anecdotes, because I really think this is such an important topic. And I wanted people to learn from the learning that I have done and the teaching that I have done over so many years.
You say at the beginning of the book that in some ways there has never been a moment like now in our nation's history, but you also say in other ways this is a moment repeated. How so?
Well, what I mean by that is that so many people have said to me in the aftermath of marches in Charlottesville or horrendous racial shootings, they've said, "Oh, I can't believe this is happening now," because they believed that we had somehow gone beyond race. The fact is, we've not gone beyond race, as I think my book points out. But the other thing is that we have lived with such racial antagonism, racial hostility, and overt acts of violence throughout our nation's history. And surely every historical period has its own unique configuration. And people are familiar with some of the events of the past, such as African-American lynching, maybe less familiar with the lynching that occurred in vast scope against Mexican-Americans following the annexation of the American Southwest. So in that sense, we've lived with racial violence and we've lived with racial antagonisms for many years, and it's not new. I think the recent events have really only uncovered a very deep vein in our society's institutions.
Just reading into the title for a moment of Getting Smart About Race. So what does that mean? How do we get smart about it?
Well, what I mean by that is to recognize how systemic racism is, that it is not only about individual attitudes, although those are important. And that once we recognize how systemic racism is, that we need to call it out at every opportunity, whatever your own racial ethnic background is. I think there's a special role for white people like myself in calling it out. And then we need to do something about it. And doing something about it means both institutional change as well as policy and programmatic change in our social institutions. I hope my book provides some resources for doing that.
You talk about 3 or 4 years ago as you started this project, and when things were bubbling over, I believe is the word you used, and certainly the case with police shootings and other events like that that were so concerning and continue to be. I'm curious as to then what, if anything, and I think I know the answer to this, but what, if anything, have we learned over the last 3 years? And where are we now on that?
I don't know that we have learned that much, because my fear about the present period is that given how overtly present white nationalism and movements for white supremacy are, I think it lets other people off the hook as if our only problem is the problem of white supremacists. And no doubt, that's a very deeply disturbing problem, but it's not the only form that racism takes in the United States. And so I don't want people in the context of the overt hostility we're witnessing now to somehow think that everybody else is off the hook, because they're not.
You have used the word overt a couple of times in our conversation, and I think it's a great word because it seems as though it had been somewhat covered, at least in polite conversation, and now there has been, and I guess people can argue as to what the reason for this is, but it has been opened up so that it can be more overt.
Well, in a way, that's the good news. It's opened it up and I hope therefore spawns some conversation and action around racism. But as my dear buddy Eduardo Bonilla Silva says, we can have racism without racists. That's the title of his book.
Yes.
And what that means is that racism can be present even when you don't see it overtly. My own neighborhood is a really good example of that. I live in what I'm embarrassed to say is pretty much an all-white neighborhood. But I don't think, as far as I know, that the people who live in my neighborhood hold racial prejudice to any great extent. And yet, if you looked at the evidence, you would say racism must be operating here because there's no people of color in this neighborhood. Why is that? Well, there are a lot of reasons for that, and they go into the heart of how real estate markets have been structured. My neighborhood in the past had racial covenants built right into the housing deeds. Those are now long gone. And yet, bank lending practices, all kinds of social patterns involving racism shape the character of my neighborhood independently of the attitudes of people who live here.
You, in the beginning of the book, you talk about racializing others and who gets to be white. And what you say is race is a process, not a thing. So what does that mean?
I use that phrase to refer to the fact also discussed throughout my book that race is a human-made concept, and it is really only that. However, it was human-made to allegedly justify the exploitation of the labor of particular groups of people. And so what I mean by race being a process is that it has been manufactured through social practices that evolve from our national history and in other parts of the world from our world history. It's not just an attribute, even though, of course, people have racial identities. I don't want to deny that. People are very proud of their racial heritage and identity. But the concept of race, as if that is something that is a trait or a biological fact, is really only one that's been historically manufactured.
I went through and highlighted so many things in this book because it's fascinating. One of the things that I really wanted to get to is, because it's such a great point, I believe, which is, you write, many people think that present-day attitudes explain racial inequality, yet, at the same time, no one thinks that they are guilty of having created it. What an amazing point that is.
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, that's true. In my teaching of undergraduates, you know, they would routinely say, well, you know, I didn't have slaves, I didn't create slavery, or I wasn't even alive during Jim Crow segregation.
This idea that
I was.
Right. This idea that they inherited it as opposed to that they are living with it and perhaps even perpetuating it.
Well, the past reverberates in the present, and then, of course, we also have present practices that contribute to this. But what I tell my students is I don't think the point here is to figure out which individuals to blame, or as my students would woefully say, I don't want to feel guilty, but now I feel guilty once I've learned about this. And I tell them to just forget the guilt. Guilt is a disabling feeling. Take some responsibility for what you've learned about.
How do you take responsibility? What's a good way of taking responsibility?
Well, I don't want to be naive about this because this is a huge problem, and what any one individual can do may be relatively small in the scheme of things. But I think the first thing is that people need to educate themselves, and I'm talking here somewhat about white people, but I also think people of color have much to learn from their own histories and from the histories of other groups. So for me, I'm an educator. What you do first is you educate yourself. You find out, you know, what is it we're really dealing with? Get to the facts. We live in a time when facts supposedly don't matter, but they really do, and the facts are there. The other thing is, I think you can absorb yourself in a world of feeling around racism. If you happen to be more privileged because of your racial status, read the literature of people of color, even if you don't happen to have friends of different backgrounds. Start to understand what it feels like to be Latina, to be African American or Asian American in this culture. There are many ways to do that. And then, of course, there are ways to get involved in local and or regional and national organizations. There's lots of ways to do that. In the back of my book, I've provided some resources to help people navigate their way through some of the things they can do, starting perhaps with simply having discussions in schools, workplaces, churches, to identify the places where one might be able to really make a difference.
Given the demographic changes that we have seen in this country over the past several decades, what does that mean to you about the future of racism?
Well, I'm not sure, because racism is a pretty dogged thing, and we know from other national examples that the number of people in a given group doesn't necessarily change the power dynamics. The best example of that was apartheid in South Africa. Whites were a mere 10% of the population and yet held total control over everybody else. I think what's happening in our demographic change is younger people are far more likely to be bi or multiracial and to have more biracial, multiracial friends. And that's probably a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they will become progressive around racial issues. They might, but we've had cases in the past where younger generations thought they really had it together and then were smarter than their elders. So I'm not sure how that is going to carry forward to the future. Unfortunately, one of the things we're witnessing now is some resentment on the part of white people as they perceive themselves becoming a smaller proportion of the population. And that might explain some of the increased racial hostility we're witnessing.
The book is such an important contribution to this issue and to understanding this issue. It's called Getting Smart About Race in American Conversation. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. Margaret Anderson, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate your calling.
Thank you very much.